I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Moe!
Robbie Robbie's weekly.
Little reverse pass. Oh! Oh!
Magic!
Hello, the 42 members. Gavin Casey here, sitting in for Murray Kinsella, who remains on well-earned leave. Only another week to go, and you'll have Murray back in your lives, I promise you. But I'm delighted to be joined by the returning Owen Toolan, who is back in Australia, first and foremost. Owen, how are you?
I'm very well. I've missed you, blokes. I think it's been almost a month. I've gotten withdrawal symptoms from the pod. I'm doing okay. I'm glad I'm talking to you because I'm in day six of hotel quarantine in Melbourne. So flew back from Osaka last Tuesday. So not gone mad just yet. It's in a nice hotel down in downtown Melbourne overlooking South Bank. But no access to fresh air, which is starting to become a little bit of an issue. But hopefully I'll get through the 15 days okay.
I did mention to you the other day that I was chatting to the boxer Dennis Hogan recently, and when he had returned to Sydney, he was in a training camp in the States. He flew back to Australia and naturally enough had to go through the same process, and he was preparing at the time for a fight against a big Australian star called Tim Tszyu, and he was able to convince the hotel receptionist that he was indeed an elite athlete, and they put him up in this lovely penthouse hotel room / apartment overlooking, I think, the Sydney Olympic Park. And when you sent me a picture of your own view the other day, I couldn't help but sense you had maybe flexed your own muscles towards the receptionist and convinced them that maybe you were about to line out for a Super Rugby team or something, because it looked like a serious setup you had up there, the frustration of being stuck inside notwithstanding.
I can safely say that has not happened. I do have a good view, but William Genia and Quade Cooper have sent me videos up there. I'm not going to call them hotel rooms. I'll call them apartments in Brisbane. And they've got a nice two-bed apartment with balcony, outdoor access. So I think there's a theme there. If you're a pretty good sportsman, you get looked after, whereas I'm most definitely down the bottom of the pile, I think.
I don't know. There seem to be a lot of people probably a few floors below you. But in all seriousness, that whole thing, the whole process, as you mentioned, day six, right? So at this point, I would imagine you are starting to feel it a little bit, particularly if you're not able to get outside. How have you been spending your time, and how have you, I guess, you know, pushed aside some of that frustration? Like, how have you made it work?
Yeah, we've actually been a little bit lucky that we asked the club if we could do quite a lot of our end of season reviews remotely. So all our player feedback interviews we've done via Zoom, which has been probably the only blessing of the global pandemic, is you get to work from remote destinations. So we've been able to get all that done whilst in quarantine. So that has passed a couple of days pretty quickly. And then outside of work, it's been, well, there was a lot of sport at the weekend, so I got to sit back and watch all the rugby, obviously both hemispheres and Japan. So that was good. And then just catching up with people in Australia as well. Some guys that I haven't talked to in a little bit. So trying to catch up on news with people in Melbourne and then over in Ireland as well. So yeah, plenty of FaceTime calls and chats. And then I get my little 20-minute hit sessions in on the TV. So I've got the sweatbands on and I'm doing jumping jacks in the middle of the hotel room watching The Body Coach. I don't know if many of the subscribers would have heard of The Body Coach. He's an English guy. He does 20-minute HIIT classes. So that's my little fitness routine every day. So I really look forward to those.
You'll definitely be upgraded to an apartment then before long, maybe before the quarantine is up. Let's talk about that debut season of yours in Japan. And obviously, since we've spoken to you last, the Lioness campaign has come to an end. But despite the fact that it ended with a fairly hefty defeat against top league opposition, you seem to equip yourselves well in that kind of knockout tournament. And it seemed to be, for you personally, I'm sure, an unbelievable experience, but also a bit of a season from which it could be a springboard for you guys to kick on a little bit. Can you give us an assessment of it in general?
Yeah, I think overall really happy with how the season progressed. Obviously disappointed we lost out on the final of the top challenge. It would have been nice to have won that competition. But yeah, to get into the playoffs with the top league boys, and four teams from the top challenge got into the playoffs, and we were the only team to win in that first playoff round. And then it was just unfortunate the kind of the structure of the season changed due to COVID. So we were due to go into a pool stage against four other teams, but they curtailed the season. So it meant we went from playing the bottom team in top league to playing the top team in top league. And that's just a very, very big jump in Japanese rugby. Only four teams have ever won top league. And the team we were playing, Panasonic, are the most successful team. I think they've won it four times. So they're the traditional powerhouse of Japanese rugby. And while we gave a good account of ourselves for about 50 minutes, it was a one-score game. And then just the power of the bench that they were able to bring on some Japanese internationals and very experienced players. And we just couldn't cope with the depth of talent they had. But they've pretty much been winning all their regular season games by 40 or 50 points. There's such a big gap between probably the top four or five teams in Japan and the rest. So realistically, we were never going to be in a position to beat Panasonic where the team is currently, but definitely trending in the right direction. Good group of players there. And I think if they can get their recruitment right in the off season, they can definitely be a part, hopefully, of that 12 team new professional competition that's slotted to take place next season. But unfortunately, there's a fair bit of ambiguity around that as well, because obviously the pinch of the pandemic on the big companies in Japan is starting to be felt, and already two companies have pulled their rugby programs. Sanix and Cola have the companies have just gotten rid of their rugby programs due to financial constraints. So it's a really bad timing for Japanese rugby. Obviously the momentum they never got after the World Cup with the last season being cancelled, and now trying to set up a professional competition. But when you have the company element to it, you're obviously kind of at the peril of their financial kind of outlook. And as I said, with the prolonged period of COVID, there's definitely economic struggles in Japan.
Yeah, for sure. And that was something I was going to ask you about, was that 12-team tournament next season, because even in the members' WhatsApp group, a few people were asking me a couple of weeks ago, what was the story with it, and even to ask yourself, and I don't think any of us arrived at a concrete answer. I guess you have given us the closest thing to that, in the sense that there is ambiguity still about it, and there's still uncertainty, I guess, as to who's going to compete in it. But if you look at what you guys did in the first round of those playoffs, and I think you're generally like, the Lioners' general performances, even reading into it, a couple of like Japanese things, like Google Translate being my savior there. It seemed to be that.
Likewise.
Yeah, it did seem to be that when you mentioned there's a kind of a top four or five in the top league, and then the rest are kind of like on a par. It seemed that you guys were on a par with them as well, that you could fit in with the rest of the top league, if you like, not a bother to eat.
Yeah, and that was the club's goal at the start of the season, was to try and break into the top eight. And as I said, that original competition structure meant we would have played in a pool of five. So we would have played four games, and that would have been a mixture of the guys ranked from one all the way down to 16. So we felt we potentially could have been competitive with those mid-table teams, and hopefully try and squeeze in as one of the winners or runners up in those pools to go into that last eight scenario. But it just, as I said, they changed the nature of the competition. It meant we went into a knockout team against the number one ranked team. So it was just, unfortunately, we didn't get to have a crack at those mid-table teams, because, as you said, there isn't a great deal between those sides, probably ranked sixth to 12, 13 particularly. So yeah, that was a shame. And yeah, just to clarify, the makeup of the 12 teams for next year will be a mixture of results this year, but also commercial applications made by all the companies. So obviously stadium has got something to do with it, sponsorship, and the rugby programs that are currently in place. So it's not just down to the results of this season to make up that those 12 teams next season. So that's still to be decided next month, and I think there'll be a bit of a geographical implication to it as well. I think the JRFU will be keen to have a presence of teams from not just Tokyo, but obviously Osaka, up north in Japan, and down south as well. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they arrive at that final decision.
It certainly will be interesting. Yeah, we haven't spoken to you obviously in a while, and the Lions tour, or the Lions squad rather, has been named in the interim, and I want to kick off with a question here from Kaylon about that before we get into the two Irish interpros from the weekend, and we'll chat about Super Rugby a little bit later on as well. But this question from Kaylon was, so he said in the Irish Times today, as in Sunday, it was theorized that Johnny Sexton may have been left out because if he's not starting, he's not the best fit for the midweek teams. Is there any credit to that, given the idea that the Lions is a squad and not a list of the 37 best players? And he was also wondering, could Hugo Keenan's incredible form be a downfall for Ireland? This time last year, we were fearful of the successor to Rob Kearney, and now we have Hugo, Mike Haley and Mike Larry all on form and pushing for selection, among others. Should Ireland stick with Hugo and try and get him more experience in the summer and autumn, or should they try and give a chance to Michael Larry, Shane Daly or Mike Haley in case Hugo gets hurt? Maybe we'll start with the Sexton question. And do you reckon that that could have been actually, or it could have worked to his detriment, the fact that he probably would have been unlikely to play midweek, and therefore he's kind of taking up a space that might be better used by somebody else?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? There's obviously been a lot of conjecture around why he hasn't been picked, and his durability has been brought into question. I just feel that Johnny Sexton has been there and done it, has played his part in winning Lions Test Series. The combination he formed with Farrell in 2017, I thought, was instrumental to the Lions at least drawing the Test Series. And for me, even if he just went down and was a part of the Saturday teams, the Test teams, and maybe had one run out in one of the midweek games, I think he just adds so much value to that Test side. And he's got so much experience under his belt. I don't feel like he needs to play a huge amount of rugby to be able to contribute to the team, just such as his tactical nous and his experience in those big Test match environments. So if it was me, I definitely would have taken him. I don't feel him not playing the midweek games would have hurt his chances. Obviously, I think it's the biggest Lions squad that's ever been announced, isn't it, with 37.
Clive brought about 55.
Sorry. I'll caveat that series, the Clive series, but outside of that, it's a pretty big squad. Yeah. So, it's obviously going to be an attritional tour, and I could definitely still see Johnny Sexton playing some part, if I'm honest. I think there's going to be a few guys dropping off, such as the kind of attritional nature of the games they're going to be playing. So, yeah, I was surprised to see him left out, especially given how it looks like Gatland's going to set up the team. It's going to be a pretty kick-heavy approach with not a lot of rugby played. So I just can't think of a better tactical kicker in the Northern Hemisphere currently.
Would you have brought him over Finn Russell? Is that fair to say? Or would you have perhaps brought him over Owen Farrell, who hasn't exactly torn up any trees in the last 6-8 months?
Yeah, the Finn Russell one is the interesting one, isn't it? Because as I said, when you look at the profile of players, particularly backs that Gatland's picked, you would think it's going to be a position-based game and trying to negate the line speed that the Springboks are going to bring based on what we saw at the World Cup. So Finn Russell doesn't... I know he's definitely played with a little bit more pragmatism in the Six Nations, and there was a level of success to that with Scotland. But I just don't feel that his... style of play necessarily fits into how the Lions are going to be set up. So it is a little bit of a surprise, if I'm honest. And if they're going to go that dual playmaking role, well, if Farrell gets injured, I can't think of another playmaker that's going to slot into that 12 position. So, it is going to be interesting how we see them set up. We obviously, the Lions got success when they went to that dual playmaking role of Sexton Farrell from the second test on in 17. So whether they're going to try and stick to that template with bigger Farrell. But as I said, a lot is going to be resting on the shoulders of Farrell that he stays fit for the entire series.
Sounds like it, yeah. To Kaylon's second question then, the fact that Hugo Keenan has to some degree established himself in the Ireland starting 15, but also is a young guy, so you want to probably further blood him, further embed him into that team and just give him the minutes that allow him to become an even more confident international player. But then, as Kaylon points out, you have guys like Mike Lowry, Mike Cayley, who's had a really impressive season as well for Munster. So with summer and autumn in mind, do you actually kind of rotate Keenan out for a test or two and give some of those guys a shot, or do you continue with Keenan in an effort to bring his game up a level, if even possible?
Yeah, I think it's a good position for Andy Farrell to be in. There was obviously concern in that position. No one had quite nailed down the jersey since Rob had retired, and Stockdale has been a revelation. And the other guy to remember is Jacob Stockdale as well, obviously coming back from injury. And he showed some glimpses, I thought, last weekend with the ball. So there's starting to build a little bit of depth. I think Farrell will be keen to give Keenan some more minutes there, but also probably Stockdale, and then have a look at, as you've mentioned, of one eye on the future in terms of a Lowry, to see how he manages the next step up along with Haley. So again, it's a good position for the coach to be in, and it'll be interesting how he sets the side up and who he looks to give some more test match experience to.
For sure. And as you were saying with Sexton, Keenan might not even be available for Ireland in the summer when push comes to shove. A couple of injuries and who knows. He's certainly banging form. We saw that at the weekend as Leinster demolished Connacht in the end. Let's chat about that game, and a bit of a weird game actually. Like, just in the sense that it was, you know, you hear of games of two halves, and this was kind of a game of a quarter and then three more quarters or something, you know. And for Leinster to, first and foremost, claw themselves back into the game as dominantly as they did while 16-0 down, I think was impressive, Owen, just on the basis that they'd had a couple of disappointing results in the previous 2 weeks, and it would have been easy at that point in a Rainbow Cup, let's be honest, which might not mean the same to them as it does to, say, Munster or a couple of the other provinces. They could have just let their heads drop and let the game pass them by, but not only did they not do that, they actually returned to something resembling rip-roaring form and did tear Connacht to shreds in the end.
Yeah, they definitely appeared to have a Heineken Cup hangover, didn't they? I've had my fair share of Heineken hangovers, and it does take you a little while to get up and running the next weekend. So, they just didn't get out of the blocks at all. And in fairness to Connacht, they got off to a really fast start, as you mentioned, 16-0 up inside the first quarter, and a couple of cheap penalties, and then a scrappy try, which Keelan Blay does well to latch on to that loose delivery from McGrath to score. And he just felt the next 5 minutes was really crucial for Connacht. If they had maintained that scoreboard pressure and maybe tagged on another 3 points, I think an element of doubt might have started to creep into the minds of Leinster. But the fact that off that restart, when they'd gone 16-0 up, that Leinster score straight away. And I think one of the telling parts of the game was the breakdown. Off that restart, it's Leinster that counter-rook Connacht. I think Connacht conceded 9 breakdown turnovers at the weekend. And that is absolutely an area that Leinster would have worked on post La Rochelle. It was probably a high-profile component to their loss against La Rochelle. I think they gave up 6 turnovers at the breakdown, Leinster. And they definitely targeted Connacht's breakdown, and they were 100% on their own ball as well. So I think that contact area and breakdown was a real focus for them, and it was the catalyst to that first try. They kind of rook Connacht off the ball, and then it's a pretty straightforward try with a nice link between Frawley and Keenan to score his first of 4 tries. But yeah, the momentum just absolutely swung in Leinster's favour for that period. And when you think, I think Connacht scored their first try in the 13th minute, and it took them another 52 minutes to score their second try. So Leinster completely dominated that middle period of the game.
I know that Connacht will be reshuffling some of their coaches next season, or sorry, shuffling the coaching setup and the makeup of it. Peter Wilkins kind of stepping up from defence, from his position as defence coach. You look at them over the last 4 games, They've conceded 160-odd points. Like, they are shipping kind of 40-odd per game at the moment. And, look, they've come up against really good opposition as well. But do you think that defence is becoming more of a concern for them than it was, say, even earlier in the season? Or is this just a kind of one of those runs of games that you just have to kind of get through and put it right? Like, do you see chinks in their armour that you might not have spotted earlier in the season? Or is it just, like, one of those things?
Definitely lacking a little bit of physicality. Obviously, three tries come from Mauls, directly from Mauls, from Leinster. So they asserted their dominance up front particularly. And Connacht are bleeding some young guys there, even in the starter positions. If you look at Anaal Murray, Sean O'Brien in the centre, there's quite a bit of inexperience in that Connacht side. And we'll probably touch on a little bit. I thought the benches were really telling. There's a number of names there for Connacht with little or no provincial experience. And when you contrast that to what was coming off the bench for Leinster, you got Irish internationals, Lions in Tadhg Furlong. So the quality that Leinster were able to bring off the bench in that second half just turned it into a little bit of a mismatch. I'm not so sure it's much to do with system problems with Connacht, more to do with the personnel and obviously trying to blood the kind of next generation of Connacht players.
Yeah, that's fair. From Leinster's point of view then, to like, we've seen them, I guess, put in, rack up scores like this in the past, and we know that they are a dominant force domestically. Did you see areas of their game, anything they didn't attack, for example, that would have raised an eyebrow a little bit or impressed you a little bit more than some of what we'd seen from them earlier in the season, particularly bearing in mind how they came unstuck in France?
Yeah, it was a definite return to that power game. As I said, multiple tries coming from Mauls, and when they got into the 22, they were ruthlessly efficient. And then I thought some of their transition attack was nice as well. As I said, I think Connacht gave up 9 turnovers from the ruck, and that try, I think it's the Kelleher try that comes off a ruck turnover just on halfway, and it's a trademark Ross Byrne kick pass to Kelleher to score. So that transition side of the game looked really sharp, and as I said, they were just bludgeoningly efficient up front with their forwards and generally came away with points when they got into the 22.
What's the next step for this Leinster team, do you think? How do they get improved compared to, like, all the conversation since the La Rochelle defeat has been, how do you drag yourselves beyond that semi-final stage now where you come up against these monstrous teams and just fall short despite all of your effort? Do you agree, say, with Bernard Jackman that you need to bring in maybe a marquee foreign signing or two just to put you over that edge a little bit and put you over the top? Or are there other areas in which Leo Cullen and Stuart Lancaster could improve that team with the resources they have at their disposal currently?
Yeah, obviously the scoreboard blew out a little bit in that second half, and I think Leinster will be disappointed with probably some of their decision making. I know you guys have already reviewed the game, but against that line, that hard press, there was three, four pass sequences in some of their starter plays, which just isn't going to get it done against that kind of defense. And probably how they manage the game, big learning experience for Ross Byrne in that high pressure environment. He's definitely developed the season, and I think that will be a big learning experience, how he managed the field, particularly in that second half. And obviously, we're talking about high profile signings, but if Sexton is in the 10 jersey, he will make a difference to that team. And then, yeah, probably a little bit of power in that second row. If you think the damage that Skelton was able to do almost single-handedly, and Leinster probably lack a little bit of power between Toner and Fardy, who are probably coming towards the end. Obviously, Scott is retiring at the end of the season, and Toner's coming towards the end of his career. So probably adding a little bit more punch. They're obviously more than capable of dominating a Pro 14 level, but we're just seeing such as the jump when you go up to the elite level of Heineken Cup, that power, especially in the engine room, is really important.
Yeah, it seems to be. And then you look at what they have been doing over the last number of years and the squad depth that they have built and how that has afforded them the opportunity to be so dominant in competitions like the Rainbow Cup or the Pro 14. And to go back to what you were saying a moment ago, you look at their bench at the weekend and who came on? Rory O'Loughlin, Jordan Larmour, Rowan Osborne, Ed Byrne, Dan Sheehan, Tadhg Furlong, Ryan Baird and Josh van der Fleer. So it's obviously not bad to have some of those guys in reserve. Do you think that was that's what actually swung it in the end, like completely in Leinster's favour, just the absolute quality they had coming off the bench? Or
yeah, I thought there was a gulf in class, particularly in that second half. I thought van der Fleer, when he came on, the area of his game that he's really improved is his carry. And I think in the lead up to one of the tries, he might have beaten four defenders just with a huge punch in his carry. And when you, as you said, if you bring on internationals off the bench to relative novices in provincial rugby from a Connacht perspective, then it's, while you can have really good coaching and all the systems you want in the world, it's the quality of players that are operating within that system that allows it to flourish. So yeah, I think there was just too big a gulf in class in that second half.
If I could put the same question to you about Connacht then, particularly when they have that little bit of a different looking coaching setup next season, I'm sure they'll be drawing a few lines under things themselves and looking to build upon what they've already started. But how do they go about that, Andy Friend and co? How do they take Connacht beyond the level that they're at now, which is certainly not bad, but they'll have aspirations, I'm sure, of improving from next season?
Yeah, and obviously new coaches are going to bring a little bit of a different slant to how they're going to try and play and blending. Obviously that field position type game in the winter months, especially over West, with a more expansive approach and trying to get the best out of the profile of athletes that they have at his disposal. And it's been another year for Andy Friend to try and recruit the type of guys that that he wants to play within the system. Obviously Mac Hansen coming over from the Brumbies, who came on in the Super Rugby final and looked really good. Obviously Bundiaki hopefully can regain some level of fitness. He's had a frustrating time out with injury, and Quinn Rue is important in that second row as well. So they're most definitely a team that if they're going to be competitive, they need to have all their big players available for selection in those key games. So yeah, absolutely about building squad depth and trying to bring through some more local based players. I think that's really important to the identity of Connacht, that they have guys coming through their system, and then mix that with a little bit of overseas flavor to try and enhance what they're trying to do at the club. So yeah, obviously a big battle for them against particularly Leinster and Munster. There's obviously a huge gulf in terms of player availability and playing numbers in the provinces, and that's always going to be their challenge, is to try and benchmark themselves against the best in Ireland. And And I thought the coaches have done a pretty good job there with the resources that they have.
Let's chat a bit Munster then. And again, first 15 minutes or so of that Ulster game, okay, it wasn't one-sided in either way, but there was that little bit of niggle between Rory Scannell and Will Addison, sorry, and it really felt like a kind of an old-fashioned interpro. I know commentators tend to say, oh, you don't want to see that. I actually do want to see it. I love seeing it. And I thought it was setting up for, or it was being set up for, a really spectacular, competitive kind of game. But even as the first half wore on, it probably became clear that wasn't going to be the case. So I think it was just Munster were so dominant at the breakdown and in a couple of those sort of physical battles on the ground, really, that it was difficult for Ulster to establish themselves in the game at all as it transpired. And in time, Munster just kind of turned the screw. It did become one-sided. Is that a fair enough assessment?
Yeah, I think it is. Probably some of the stats are pretty telling when you look at metres made, when you're talking about those collisions and the contact area gap, that metres made for Munster was 542 compared to 298 for Ulster. So in terms of those, and they had Ulster actually had more carries than Munster, 138 carries to 127. So with obviously Munster were dominating those physical exchanges, and when Ulster went down to 14 men with the Addison red card, it became really difficult for them. And I thought particularly their structured defense, that they when you reflect on that opening try, it's a left-hand scrum, probably 15 metres from the Ulster line, and Coombs. It's brilliant from Coombs. His athleticism and his power and contact is fantastic. But if you reflect on Ulster's structured defence, the seven misses the initial tackle, and then McCluskey just goes far too high on Coombs, and they soak 15 metres, and Coombs just gets pulled up short. I thought that was a pretty a poor structured defence sequence from Ulster, and a couple of phases later they use Coombs as a decoy and Scannell goes in under the posts, and there was a couple more tries from Munster off structured attack when Ulster were down to 14, and they just didn't manage that connection between obviously the departed 13 and the open winger, whether it was Rob Little on one wing or on the other wing, Ethan McElroy, just that connection between wing and McCluskey was just lacking at times, and Munster scored a couple of what were pretty soft first phase tries. Obviously difficult when you're down a man, but they're the types of scenarios in training that you definitely will plan for in terms of being down a back and how you manage your structured defence off those sequences.
So do you think as far as Ulster go, it actually was more structural, even when they were at full complement, that their defensive frailties, if you like, in this game did come down to structure more so than, like, say, individual errors or even talent deficit?
I think it was still a relatively close game. Was it 12-3 when Addison gets red carded, perhaps? And then on Munster go in for that third try just before halftime. So I thought Ulster were competitive. They looked, as we mentioned, in the first quarter, they looked dangerous. I thought particularly McCluskey and Addison were making big inroads into the Munster defence. And Henderson, I thought, was showing why he is selecting the Lions squad. I think he was top tackler, top ball carrier for his team, and gets a try. So I thought Ulster, there didn't appear to be a huge gulf in class in that first half. But I thought that try just on half time was probably a key score for Munster and asserted a bit of scoreboard pressure. And while Ulster did well to hang in there at the start of second half and got that crucial first try through Henderson, it was probably the mounting pressure that begun to tell on Ulster and maybe a little bit of the inexperience of Lowry playing at 10, throwing that intercept. That was the game done when he throws that intercept to Scannell. I think he might have come up with 5 turnovers in the game, so obviously difficult down and back, but his inexperience at 10 was probably telling in that second half.
Murray, as in Murray Kinsella, was making the point on Air Sport that he would be reticent to get too excited on behalf of Munster fans just about how they played in attack, purely on the basis that it is the Rainbow Cup, and look, we've probably seen a couple of false dawns, if you like, with Munster, even this season, where they have put together similar-ish performances, and then against, say, Leinster, they revert to something a little bit more conservative and it doesn't quite come off against them. Now, they've beaten Leinster since that, I'm aware, but that being said, I thought, as an overall body of work, it was about the most impressive attacking performance I've seen Munster put in this season, just in terms of, I guess, the skill level. You mentioned Coombs' offloads, and it wasn't just him. Now, you could argue the offloads were probably there for them too readily. Like, there was players popping the ball up off the ground, which was probably an indication that Ulster weren't challenging enough or even getting to the breakdown quickly enough. But I guess from Stephen Larkham's point of view and Johan van Graan's point of view, it was a good day at the office in terms of how well it all came together and how nice it looked, to be honest.
Yeah, I thought Key was probably getting quick ruck speed. Obviously, when the ruck speed is quick, it allows your players to operate within the shape a lot more effectively. And then some of their structured sequences were nice. The Hanrahan try, the fifth Munster try, is that play was seen all too often this year. The 9, 12, 13 short and 10 out the back. And 10, again, Hanrahan just goes at that little bit of a disconnect between Rob Little, who's now defending in that unfamiliar position as 13 effectively, and McCluskey, and Little goes into jockey mode rather than trying to jam on Hanrahan, and he's trying to get McCluskey to push off that front runner running that blocker line, and McCluskey just isn't able to get there, and Hanrahan shows great pace and acceleration to score. But yeah, really well executed play from Munster, and there was signs when they're operating off that lightning quick ball that you could see the evolution in their shape.
Do you think that's a sustainable way of playing? Say, if we were talking about Leinster, how Leinster can possibly get over the line in those sort of massive European semi-finals against massive teams. Like, do you think with Munster, when they play even Leinster next season, for example, and when both teams are at full strength this time around, that they need to play a little bit more like that than they did, say, at the RDS 2 games ago? Or in that defeat against Leinster, do you feel that maybe just Munster weren't allowed to play as well? Like, that might be a fair argument. I'm just wondering how much of that they can replicate next season in big games of their own, and how sustainable it is versus opposition that are on a par with you or better than you on paper.
Yeah, I think that probably fits into the big picture planning of the club. Obviously, if you bring in a guy like Steve Larkham, you're looking to expand your game. You're not looking to narrow your game. He's a well-taught coach that's very inventive, creative in terms of his first phase strikes. So Munster bringing Larkham to the club is a dead set sign that they're trying to evolve their game and have a multifaceted threat to how they're trying to play. You're not trying to go one way or the other. You need really good balance in your game. We'll talk a little bit about it with the Crusaders, how Richie Mwanga has been absolutely hailed for his world-class display at the weekend. He kicked the ball 18 times and had almost as high a kicking ratio to passing ratio. So the balance in your game is crucially important, and being able to break down teams in multiple different ways. That's what the world-class teams do. They have a system and a structure to how they're trying to play, but within that they can have variation to deal with those hard press defenses, or if it's a soft defense that's giving you easy access to the edges, you're able to take that. So I think at top level rugby now, you need to be able to play the game in different ways, and the challenge for Munster now is to try and fit the players into that game model in terms of how Larkham is trying to play the game. And I think you're starting to see the emergence of some exciting new talent, probably a more mobile background with Coombs coming in. I really like the look of Shane Daly on the wing. I thought he looks really athletic. We've mentioned Mike Haley as well, his counter-attack threat. So they're starting to find a bit of a balance. Obviously, they brought in Deland and Snyman, who obviously hasn't played this year. So you get those two guys on the pitch as well. It gives you the opportunity to play that power game, or also with Delande's distribution skills to be able to play a bit more expansively. So I think it's them trying to find that balance and being able to play in multiple ways when it comes to those big European and big Pro 14 games.
Let's chat about Richie Mwanga and the lads then. Is this Crusaders outfit the most impressive club side you've ever seen? I guess not just this particular squad, but this succession of squads that they've put together in the last decade or so. Is there any real question about this anymore? They're just so dominant, so good, and so impressive in every aspect, really.
Yeah, just able to win. Is that five in a row now, Super Rugby titles? I saw a stat of one of their last 24 knockout games in Super Rugby. They've won all 24 when playing as host, and that's including six finals that they've played at home, which just goes to show they're an absolute winning machine. And probably wasn't, they started off like a house on fire. Mwanga was central to everything they were doing. Brilliant cutout pass to Reese for the first try, and then a lovely bit of skill from Havili, that little show and grubber for Bridge to score. And some of the skills in that opening 20 minutes were beyond anything I've seen this year from an international or a club context. I thought they were absolutely outstanding. But Chiefs, as have done all Super Rugby Aotearoa, just hung in there, managed to stay in touch with some penalty goals. And then Crusaders were as inaccurate and ill-disciplined as I've seen for a while. I think they had 18 turnovers in the game and 14 penalties with two yellow cards. So Crusaders probably after that first 20 weren't at their absolute best, but they just absolutely found a way to win, and probably illustrated best with not allowing Chiefs. I think they conceded 3 points when they were down to 13 men, and Chiefs had all the field position. Obviously McKenzie misses a couple of kickable penalties, but I thought the resilience they showed to not fall behind when they're two men down was championship winning form.
Even how they manage that spell when they're down to 13, because we'll chat about the Reds and the Brumbies in a moment. And listen, the Brumbies did incredibly well to hold out for as long as they did, and to defend as they did with 13, but ultimately they were breached for the game winning score. And this Crusaders, like, just it's kind of an illustration, I guess, where you're talking about two of the best teams in the Southern Hemisphere. This Crusaders team is on a slightly different level, and it is how they are able to manage those moments as well as how brilliantly they're able to play. Like, there seems to be a huge psychological advantage that they have nearly over opposition, and I guess just this, like, it's too easy to describe it as a belief, I think, but I don't know how else to describe it is the thing.
Yeah. And world-class moments. I got to say, the moment of the game is, so it's 15-12, and Chiefs exit from their C zone, put up a lovely contestable kick, and the wind is starting to swirl, the rain is starting to come down. Mwanga's under the high ball, and the Chiefs winger must be absolutely licking his lips. It's a contestable kick. I think it's Jonah Lowe, absolutely charging down in Mwanga, and you fear for Mwanga that he's going to get cut in two. And the composure he shows, he's actually backpedaling, but walking as he's backpedaling under the high ball, and just shows such composure to step away from the onrushing Lowe as he catches the ball and makes a 40-meter line break down that left side. And that was the moment I think Crusaders won the game. If Chiefs affect the kick chase, big impact tackle, might come up with a turnover there, and they're on the front foot. And conversely, it's Crusaders down in Chiefs 22. Mwanga dusts himself off, a couple of phases eventuate, and then off penalty advantage, he steps up, and I think he hits the first drop goal of his professional career. I think Raj probably would have taken quite a lot of delight in that moment. It was just such a big moment to go 18-12. Mwanga was just imperious in that moment. And as I said, world-class players win you titles, and that was certainly a world-class moment from one of the best in the world at the moment.
Yeah, he's become world-class undeniably probably since 2017 when we saw him burst on the international scene. And even back then, there was probably I wouldn't go as far as to describe it as doubt, but there was definitely a sense that New Zealand were going to kind of play it by ear. Even chatting to some people from there, it was like, we know he's talented, we don't know how reliable he is yet. He was a young guy, in fairness, probably about 22, 23 at the time. He has established himself now as world-class, but where does he fit in that conversation of, say, the best Kiwi 10s we've seen in the last 10, 12 years? Like, is he at that level now of your Bowden Barretts, or does he still have a bit of work to do, to your mind?
Probably still has to prove it in a test match, doesn't he? I think that's still the question mark. It's not comparable to what Dan Carter has done in his career. He's most certainly the best 10 that's ever played the game, in my opinion. And that balance, interestingly, Bowden Barrett has kind of made it known he wants to return in the 10 jersey when he comes back from his sabbatical in Japan. And how New Zealand play, they're obviously trying to accommodate Mwanga and Barrett in that back line, but it probably just hasn't clicked enough for New Zealand yet. So it's going to be interesting when it comes to All Black selection, because the other guy, the other Barrett we need to think of is Geordie Barrett and how brilliantly he's been playing. And he's definitely not a winger. I think probably New Zealand have fallen victim to trying to accommodate all their best backs in the one team by playing Bowden at 15 and Geordie on the wing, and I don't think that's either their best position. So it's going to be very interesting when it comes to the July series and the Rugby Championship, the makeup of those seven backs and where Richie Mwanga fits into it.
Let's look at the Australian final then, and this one, what a storybook ending first and foremost for James O'Connor, but the whole thing felt kind of massive, and I saw there were like record TV numbers, record attendances, like free air, I would suggest, has a huge amount to do with that, and it kind of does.
Yeah.
It is an indicator of how healthy a game can be once it's exposed to so many eyeballs. And actually, just as we've been speaking on, there's news has broken that RTE and Virgin Media will share the rights to the Six Nations going forward. I haven't looked at the article while I've been speaking to you, but it looks like that in the short-term future, at least, that the Six Nations will remain on terrestrial TV here, which is great. But we probably saw the effects of that in Australia, as I'm trying to say. And a fitting way then for that final to go, for the Reds to finally get over the line, both figuratively and literally, and for a guy who's had his issues to be the hero of the moment while half the country is watching.
Yeah, Australia have definitely needed a good news story from a rugby context. It's been a really tough, probably almost since 2015, since Australia made the World Cup final. It's been a 6 years of not a whole lot of positivity in Australian rugby, obviously struggling under the old Super Rugby competition structure and just not being able to compete with the Kiwis and the South Africans generally. So I think Super Rugby AU has been a blessing for Australian rugby to allow those Australian guys experience what it's like to win big titles in front of large crowds, because it's something that's been alien to them for too long. And you're right, an absolute redemption story for James O'Connor, where his career was probably 2 years ago. No one wanted him in Australian rugby, and he looked like his career was coming to such an unfortunate end. For I have to say, when I first started watching him at 17, he was without doubt one of the most talented players I've ever seen. Just his explosiveness, his ball skills, he just seemed to have it all. And it was just so sad to see his career deteriorated the way it has done. And he's been really open and honest about the challenges he's faced. And I think it was obviously fitting that he was scoring the game-winning try, but also for the Reds team. Brad Thorns had that young group of players now for, I think this is the third or fourth Super Rugby season, and they were at rock bottom. They couldn't win a game in the first couple of years, but that core group of players, it just goes to show you, if you build an identity around homegrown players from the state and believe in them and stick with them and the coach through those tough times, and understand that there's a big picture plan. A lot of talented guys are coming through that Red system, and they've finally got what they probably deserved. They've been the foreign team in Australian rugby this year, and by no means did they play their best game in the final. I thought Brumbies really, really unlucky to lose. I think obviously what a bizarre finish to the game in terms of two yellow cards in the last couple of minutes, and I think Brumbies were on the receiving end of a 21-8 penalty count in favour of the Reds. So I think Dan McKellar would be really disappointed with that aspect, and just an absolutely bonkers finish, wasn't it? When you think the Reds go to the corner, they've got a man advantage, and then they overthrow at the line out. Brumbies go to kick out, Reds kind of half charge it down, so now it's Brumbies line out inside their 22. They've been absolutely imperious on their line out all day. It was a story of two set pieces. The Reds line out, I think they were at 92%. The only line out they lost in the game was that last line out, and probably points to a little bit of inexperience for Brumbies. They've had a few high profile injuries the last couple of weeks. Cusack in the back row, obviously losing Slipper as well, a couple of really high profile international class players, and it's poor Henry Stowers that the ball gets thrown to at the front. If they catch the line out, they wind down the clock and they win. And the Reds managed to turn over the line out, pick and go, just get held up short. And then there's another binning. So now they're against six forwards. Their scrum has been absolutely dominant all day long. The freak that is Taniela Tupou played for 87 minutes, tight head prop, and absolutely demolished the Brumby scrum. So you're just thinking they're just going to go to scrum, look for the penalty, play off penalty advantage, or try and get a penalty try from the scrum. They do that the first time, and then inexplicably the second time they choose to tap and go, and everyone's just screaming at the TV going, what are you doing tapping and going? You've only got six forwards against you in the scrum. But it pays off for them in the end, with Tupou just gets held up short, and then the young nine, Kalani Thomas, does brilliantly to have the composure to kind of throw a lovely little loop pass to James O'Connor to score. But it was just a bonkers finish. Like, God help the both sets of coaches in the coaches box. They would have been absolutely losing their minds. But yeah, an exciting finish, and Suncorp went absolutely mental. I know a few guys that were at the game and they said it was one of the best atmospheres they've been at in a long time in terms of Australian rugby. So as I said, Australian rugby has needed a good news story. You've mentioned the viewings on TV. They've gone down the subscription route as well with Stan, and I think that's been a massive success as well. I think that's probably points to a little bit to the future in terms of those subscription-based rights for sporting events as well.
Yeah, it certainly does. And as you said, absolute heart attack moments at the end for the coaches. But just to give the Brumbies their due before I let you go, Owen, they defended incredibly well in the circumstances, like a couple of massive tackles, a couple of like front defensive stands, I guess. And there was part of me, as much as I wanted to see the Reds win, just because I guess the Brumbies were champions, and give somebody else their moment. When the Brumbies were down to 13, it was kind of like, it would be amazing if they hold out, you know, like they almost, like they weren't a million miles off.
No, I was gutted for them, to be honest. Funny story, actually, Dan McKellar, the Brumbies coach, was player coach in junior rugby in Ireland with Wicklow. And he was my rugby coach up in St. Gerard's when I was about 12. So me and Dan go quite a long way back. And one of the analysts at the club, Owen McVeigh, came through the internship program at the Rebels. So I've kind of got a connection with the Brumbies, and I was kind of rooting them on to win. So gutting for them. I thought they went in with a really good game plan, managed field position exceptionally well. Nick White was excellent for them at nine. And then they've got loads of kicking options in their back line with Lolo Osea, Simone, Tom Wright, Muirhead, Banks, all good kickers. And I thought they probably exposed that territorial dominance on Queensland, and went in with a really good game plan, as I said, missing some really high-profile players for them. And they almost eked out back-to-back Super Rugby titles. They've been the standard bearers in Australian rugby for a number of years now, and they run a really good program up there. Obviously, Laurie Fisher, he has links with Ireland through his days at Munster with Tony McGann. And they have a real identity about how they play the game. And yeah, for them to come so close to, they've got a terrible record in Suncorp as well. I think 2015 was the last time they won there. So to come so close and not get over the line, I think will be really disappointing for them. But a valiant effort in defeat, which is no solace to the coaches or players.
What a lineage of rugby personalities in St. Gerard's. You think Dan McKellar coaching yourself, and then Owen Toolan coaching a young man by the name of Andrew Hosier Byrne once upon a time as well, who people may or may not recognise.
Don't forget Jack Conan as well. That I sent him a message the other day and goes, I knew he was a Lion from the time I saw him running around the back pitch in St. Gerard. So great for Gerard's to have a Lions player from the school. It's a huge achievement. Delighted for Jack.
Yeah, it's class. And I suppose I should ask you seriously, when you did see him playing back then, was there something special about him? Did you see like real legitimate talent, or would it be a bit too early, do you think?
Yeah, he was twice the size of everyone in his class. I think he was 6 foot from the age of about 14, so it wasn't hard for him to stand out. And he had a real he was a very good Gaelic football player, so he had a real football ability about him around the pitch. So yeah, he stood out like a sore thumb. And yeah, you could tell from an early age he was definitely talented enough to go on to bigger and better things.
Did Hosier ever give you a blast of an initiation song or something in the dressing room? Obviously his talent's probably laid elsewhere, as it transpired.
Yeah, well, see, I'm tone deaf, so it would have been hard for me to recognize his musical talents. I definitely didn't see any rugby talents in him from an early age. He had the height, all right, but I don't think he had too much interest in rugby. He was a very smart man, choosing the music career. It's been kind to him, and what a talented young man he is.
Certainly is. Owen, thanks a million. Pleasure as always. I'll let you get back to...
I don't know how we got to that. That was an interesting conversation.
As soon as you mentioned Dan McKellar coaching and Gerard's, I had to bring up the Hosier thing, because I don't think I've mentioned it on the pod before, but I just love it. Thanks to our friend Mikey Trainer, who you also coached, was the one who alerted me to that. I think he was tuning into one of the pods one day.
Good little hook back in his day, Mikey.
Yeah, multi-talented guy. He's working over in BT Sport now, actually, in London. He works in production and stuff with them. Very creative guy, former colleague of mine at balls.ie, a different sports website. So there you go.
Brilliant.
Listen, I was going to say I'll let you get back to it. I know I'm only letting you get back to hotel quarantine, but you are nonetheless a busy man, and come here, appreciate your time as always. It was a pleasure.
Can we have another hour and we'll chat soccer just to keep me occupied?
Yeah, I know.
Both of us. Podcast for next hour. I've got lots to talk about Man United.
A breakaway Man United podcast. Yeah, we are both fans.
Yeah, let's do it.
I did say to you, I think you're right about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Like, you know, you called me up on it on Twitter about 6 months ago. I think I was critical of some performance, or maybe when they went out of the Champions League or something. But look, he seems to have the right idea, I suppose.
Yeah, stick with him. You got to have patience with these managers.
Well, there you go. We've just seen that with the Queensland Reds. Thanks a million.
Cheers, bud. Chat soon.
Mind yourself. Thanks to all of the 42 members as well for your questions. I think I missed a couple of them. Apologies, but swing back around for Thursday as well. You know the story. Thanks for all of your support as well, which makes these podcasts possible. Until Thursday, mind yourselves and take it easy. Amen. 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 Take me to church. I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God. Let me give you my life. I don't think we met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
Robbie's weekly.
Getting the first pass. Oh! Oh! Drive to Ireland!
Magic!